Krishna. Did I come early today? It looks like the hall is half full today. Hare Krishna. You want to say something? That's what I say. You shouldn't feel sorry because you're already there. Okay. So this morning we discussed chapter 20 of the 11th canto, and now we are going into the 23rd chapter of the 11th canto. This chapter is very special because in this chapter Krishna speaks about the Avanti Brahmana. And Avanti is this place, Ujjain. So it's a story of a Brahmana who hailed from Avanti. Although he was a Brahmana, but he was a merchant, a businessman. And he was very, very wealthy, very rich. And although he was very rich, but he was extremely miserly. Often very rich people are very miserly. Because unless you're miserly, you can't save money. If you earn money and spend money, then you... This we have experienced in our course of preaching and collecting donations. That most of the time, the big donations don't come from very rich people. The big donations often come from rather middle rich people. And anyway, it is the nature. Like sometimes some people are miserly. And they just want to, they're in love with money. Therefore they just don't want to spend money. So same was the case with the Avanti Brahmana. He didn't want to spend any money. Not for his relatives, not for his wife, not for his children, not for his daughter. And he wouldn't even spend the money for himself. So that's the thing with the miser. A miser doesn't want to spend money. He wants to save money. Because he's just in love with money. He doesn't see the utility of money. What is the purpose of money? They're just in love with money. So they just want to save it and save it and save it. And not only that, he would not also spend any money for for performing yajnas, sacrifice for the Lord. And it is considered that it's advised that the householders perform panchasuna yajna. It was in the past, don't worry about that. Because in this age, Kali Yuga's yajna is chanting Hare Krishna. Sankirtan yajna. So whoever is chanting Hare Krishna is performing all the yajnas, all the demigods are pleased, all the controllers, Ishwaras are pleased, all the Supreme Personality of Godhead is pleased. But this was, you can well imagine, Krishna is narrating this story, so it must have been so long ago when the householders are expected to perform yajnas. And because he did not perform these yajnas, the demigods were not satisfied with him. And as a result of that, the demigods became disappointed with him, upset with him. So the demigods started to withdraw their mercy from him. And as a result of that, he started to lose everything. And how did he lose? How did he lose all his wealth? Some of his wealth is lost by, they're taken away by his relatives. Some of his wealth were taken by the thieves. Some by the whims of providence. Some by the effects of time. Some by ordinary people. And some by government authorities. So when it comes to lose, when the demigods are displeased, then one may lose everything because they have the superior control, and by their arrangement, one may lose everything. Here again, you won't have to be afraid of the demigods. Because you are chanting Hare Krishna and serving Krishna, so demigods won't dare to do anything to you. So this way he lost, when his property was completely lost, and who never engaged in religiosity or even sense enjoyment. He did not even indulge in sense gratification, sense enjoyment, although he was so rich. So his family members started to ignore him. Now it is their turn. All this while, he was neglecting his family members. When they were dependent upon him, he did not take care of them. Therefore now, it is their turn. So, they started to neglect him. So much so that They would not even speak to him. They would not offer any food to him. And they would insult him with harsh words. Even his servants would treat him badly. What to speak of his wife and children. And his servants also. Because this is the material nature. When you have money, everyone worships you. When you don't have money, everyone, even your close family members, neglect you. Especially when somebody all of a sudden becomes poor. Or when a rich man becomes poor, he becomes an object of disregard for everyone. Because it is kind of, they take their revenge. So that is why it is very important that we always deal nicely with people. When you deal nicely with people, then people will remember that. And at the time of difficulty and distress, they will come forward and help us. But when they are neglected, then they resent it, and then they reciprocate. Oh, all this while you treated me like this, now my turn has come. Now is the time for me to treat you badly. So in this way, Krishna is actually speaking about the material nature. In this material nature, people generally tend to be very selfish. Having lost all his wealth, he felt great pain and lamentation. His throat choked up with tears. And he meditated for a long time on his fortune. And then a very powerful feeling of renunciation came over him. Because he saw this way, the futility of material nature. So when he felt that way, then he began to consider, what a great misfortune I have. I have simply tormented myself uselessly, struggling so hard for money that was not even intended for religiosity or even material enjoyment. I collected money that could have been engaged in or utilized in noble purpose, in a religious purpose, benefiting others. And I didn't, or the money can be used in sense gratification. That also I didn't do. I did not use it for religious purpose, nor did I use it for sense gratification. So I just earned and earned and earned this money, and now that it is lost, I can see that what was the ill influence of money. Because today I lost everything, people are disregarding me, insulting me, treating me so badly. So this Brahmana then felt deep detachment. Why become attached to this material nature? Relatives and friends and everyone whom I thought to be so dear to me, look how they're treating me today. Generally, the wealth of misers never allows them any happiness. In this life, it causes their self-torment, and when they die, it sends them to hell. Whether pure fame is possessed by famous or whatever praiseworthy qualities are found in the virtuous are destroyed by even a small amount of greed. Just as one's attractive physical beauty is ruined by a trace of white leprosy. He is speaking now about his realization. Theft, violence, speaking lies, duplicity, lust, anger, perplexity, pride, quarreling, enmity, faithlessness, envy, and the dangers caused by women, gambling and intoxication are the 15 undesirable qualities that contaminate men because of greed for wealth. To earn money, people indulge in these undesirable qualities. The 15 undesirable qualities. To get money, people steal. To get money, people become violent. To get money, people speak lie, become duplicitous. As a result of that, lust, anger, perplexity, pride develop. Quarreling takes place, enmity develops, faithlessness. So in this way, just because of this one thing, money, people develop all these bad qualities. Therefore, it is intelligent not to become attached to money. Rather, when it comes, use it in Krishna's service and use it also in a sense gratification. To some extent, there is no harm. Because the householders, they can indulge in sense gratification. Like householders are meant to have nice living facilities and but along with that, make it a point to utilize your wealth, utilize Lakshmi, Devi, in the service of Krishna. Then Lakshmi Devi will be pleased, Krishna will be pleased. But when the wealth is not used in Krishna's service, simply used in sense gratification, then the tendency is something like one is trying to enjoy Lakshmi. And it's a great offense to enjoy Lakshmi Devi, who is the eternal consort of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, to try to enjoy her. But if that wealth is used, even if it's not whole, the entire amount, but even if she is used in Krishna's service, she'll be pleased. That's why the advice has always been given that contribute a part of your income in Krishna's service. This is how we develop this culture of addressing money as Lakshmi in ISKCON. We don't say money, rupiah, dollars, etc. We call it Lakshmi. Simply to remind ourselves that she is Krishna's, Narayan's property, not our property. But Narayan is giving us the facility. Just as the father offers facilities to his children, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is also offering the facilities to his children. And in this way, in Krishna consciousness, one can have a very joyful life. Even the material life becomes joyful. Generally, the wealth of misers never allow them any happiness. In this life, it causes their self-torment, and when they die, it sends them to hell. So miser means one who doesn't use Lakshmi. Lakshmi, if it is used in Krishna's service, that's one utility, and also money can be used in sense gratification or to create future security. That is also all right for the householder. Save some money for the future, save some money for the children education and so forth. Then he is talking about the ills of the money, wealth. Even a man's brothers, wife, parents and friends united with him in love will immediately break off their affectionate relationships and become enemies over a single coin. That is the power of this illusory aspect. For even a small amount of money, these relatives and friends become very agitated and their anger is inflamed. Acting as rivals, they quickly give up all sentiments of goodwill and will reject one at a moment's notice, even to the point of committing murder. Like it happens, just for the sake of some money, people murder. Those who obtain human life, which is prayed for even by the demigods, and that human birth becomes situated as a first-class brahmanas, are extremely fortunate. If they disregard this important opportunity, they are certainly killing their own self-interest and thus achieve a most unfortunate end. He was actually talking about himself, like he got a human birth, which is envied by even the demigods, prayed for even by the demigods. And in that human birth, he was situated as a first-class brahmana. He was so fortunate. But because he didn't take advantage of that opportunity properly, it came to a most unfortunate end. What mortal man, having achieved this human life, which is the very gateway to both heaven and liberation, would willingly become attached to that abode of worthlessness, material prosperity? This human form of life actually awards us the opportunity to become elevated to heavenly planet. It offers us the opportunity to achieve liberation. It awards us the opportunity to achieve the ultimate perfection of life, to become a pure devotee of the Lord. Of course, here he is not talking about the pure devotional service. But what a waste of time if such opportunity is misused in material prosperity. Even if enjoy is the goal, what kind of enjoyment we can get here? The enjoyment in heavenly planets is unlimited times more enjoyable. But here we are wasting this opportunity for some trivial material prosperity. So you can see that how deeply this person is seeing his situation. And this also shows that sometimes it is better to lose everything and come to a very, very unfortunate situation. Because that wakes us up. That makes us see the reality. Makes us see the reality. And that's what happened to this person. He was so wealthy. And he must have been. But he is seeing himself that he didn't utilize his wealth. He didn't develop relationship with his family members, relatives. He didn't have any friend. He didn't treat anybody properly. But they were tolerating him because he had money. But now that he lost all his money, he began to see that they all practically pounced on him to pay him the return of what they received from him all this while. Oh, this is another very nice point. One who fails to distribute his wealth to the proper shareholders. Who are the proper shareholders? The demigods, sages, forefathers, ordinary living entities, as well as his immediate relatives. Devarshi bhutapta nrinang pitrinam. Devas, rishis, other human beings, forefathers, and relatives, immediate relatives. One who does not utilize his money by giving the shares of the shareholder. Some shares are meant for demigods. Some shares are meant for rishis. And so forth. Like, some shares are meant for the king or the government in the form of tax. Some is meant to be utilized for the upkeep of the family members and so forth. So, one who doesn't give the share to the shareholders of the wealth is maintaining his wealth simply like a jaksha, and will fall down. Jaksha is actually the keeper of wealth, the protector of wealth. They're like the ghosts. And they protect the wealth from... Sometimes it happens like... If somebody comes to take the wealth, something happens to those people. like some of them dying, many of them dying, just an accidental death, because the jakshas are protecting that wealth. When somebody tries to take it, they protect it. I heard that was also the case in the pyramids in Egypt. Those who excavated the pyramids, most of them had a very, very unfortunate and accidental end. Sometimes there is a way of making jaksha also. People, like again, these miserly people, to protect their wealth, they make someone die there to protect the wealth. That reminds me of a short story of a jaksha. You want to hear that? This story was written by Rabindranath Tagore. It's one of his short stories, actually. Since we mentioned about jaksha, the thing came to my mind. There was a miser like this. And he was so miserly that he would not give anything to even his wife, his children, his only son. And as a result of that, after the son got married and got a child, being completely disgusted with his father, he left home. He went away. And so this man eventually become very old. He's alone, no one is there with him. But he has this immense wealth. He kept it in a chamber underground. And, you know, the basketfuls are full of gold and jewels and things that he saved. From time to time, he would go and see the thing, that everything is intact. Then, one day, he saw one boy, a little boy, and so he got to know that this boy has run away from home. So he just kept him, said, okay, come and stay with me. So one or two days, and then he got a bright idea. He took that boy to the place where his wealth was kept. He had to climb down with a ladder. So he took the boy and he showed the boy all the wealth. And the boy is very excited and all. And then he climbed up the ladder and he pulled the ladder out. And he started to tell him that give this wealth to the son of such and such person, his own sons. And he, I think, even, anyway, so he made this boy into a jaksha. Like his intention was to kill him. And this boy, he was telling him to protect this wealth for his descendant. So he pulled up the ladder and let the boy be there to die so that he would become a jaksha. Then after a few days, his son came and he told him that, did you see this such and such boy? Actually what happened is, then he realized that the boy who actually made Yaksha was his own grandson. Anyway, it's just a story that I read a long time ago, came to my mind. People, those who are really intelligent and able to understand the purpose of their existence, they know how to utilize their money, youth and strength to achieve perfection. But I have feverishly squandered these in the useless endeavor for further wealth. Now that I am an old man, what can I achieve? Why must an intelligent man suffer by his constant vain efforts to get wealth? Indeed, this whole world is most bewildered by someone's illusory potency. For one who is in the grips of death, what is the use of wealth or those who offer it? Sense gratification or those who offer it. Or for that matter, any type of fruitive activity which simply causes one to again take birth in the material world. Now he's coming to the main point. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Hari, who contains within himself all the demigods, must be satisfied with me. Indeed, he has brought me to this suffering condition and forced me to experience detachment, which is the boat to carry me over this ocean of material life. What a wonderful realization. Now, going through this extreme failure, extreme disappointment, extreme hurt, extreme insult, he is just seeing Krishna's hands in it. It's my good fortune that he led me to this. If there is any time remaining in my life, I'll perform austerities and force my body to subsist on the bare necessities. Without further confusion, I shall pursue that which constitutes my entire self-interest in life, and I shall remain satisfied within the self. If there is any time remaining in my life, so now he is considering that Krishna has forced me to this situation for my own benefit. Krishna is waking me up to the spiritual awareness. Therefore, if there is any time remaining in my life, I will perform austerities and force my body to subsist on the bare necessities. Without further confusion, I shall pursue that which constitutes my entire self-interest in life, and I shall remain satisfied within the self. Thus, may the presiding demigods of these three worlds kindly show their mercy upon me. Then he remembered how Maharaj Khattanga was able to achieve the spiritual world in a single moment. So this story has been mentioned but did not narrate, hasn't been narrated. How many of you know the story of Khatanga? Okay, how many of you do not know? Okay. Khatanga was a king who was fighting on behalf of the demigods with the demons. So then, after the battle was won, the demigods wanted to award him, reward him for his support, and they fought so valiantly on their behalf. So, so demigods asked Khatanga. So demigod told Khatanga. So Khatanga asked for any boon. Tell us what you want. And what was Khatanga's response? Let me know. Please tell me how much time I have left. And they said, 1 moment. And he simply wanted to become Krishna conscious, left his body, went back to Godhead. Even if 1 moment is left, and if we can utilize it in thinking about Krishna, dedicating ourselves to Krishna, we can achieve our perfection. Lord Sri Krishna continued, his mind thus determined that most excellent Avanti Brahmana was able to untie the knots of desire within his heart. He then assumed the role of a peaceful and silent sannyasi mendicant. He wandered about the earth, keeping his intelligence, senses and life here under control. To beg charity, he travelled alone to various cities and villages. He did not advertise his advanced spiritual position and thus was not recognized by others. O kind Uddhava, seeing him as an old, dirty beggar, rowdy persons would dishonor him with many insults. So now that he became a sannyasi, he wandered about the earth, keeping his intelligent senses and life here under control. To beg charity, he travelled alone to various cities and villages. He did not advertise his advanced spiritual position and thus was not recognized by others. So now he left everything and he became a sannyasi. So he is just traveling, wandering around, paribrajak. He's just wandering around. And seeing him in that condition, rowdy people would dishonor him with many insults. Some of these persons would take away his sannyas rod. Some the water pot which he was using as a begging bowl. Some took his deerskin seat. Some his chanting beads. And some would steal his torn, ragged clothing. Displaying these things before him, they would pretend to offer them back, but would then hide them again. We can see even those days they were cruel people. This kind of people there in the world all the time. But generally, I would say in India people were, sometimes they may encounter people like that, but oftentimes, people are very nice in India. Especially, they treat sannyasis and sadhus very nicely. I have some experience myself. That was in 1979, long time ago. I was traveling with some devotees in Punjab. I was in Chandigarh. So my intention was actually to go from Chandigarh to Kurukshetra. And we decided to walk on foot. But we took the wrong turn. And instead of going towards Kurukshetra, we started to walk the other direction, towards the mountain. Anyway, we just started to walk. And our intention was to go to Kurukshetra, but we took the wrong direction. And then we were walking. I had about 5-6 boys with me. All our brahmacharis. I was a sannyasi. So we were walking. And then we got tired and we saw a temple in a village. Outside the village. The temple was not exactly within the village. So outside the village. So we thought that we'll just take some rest there. We are not even sitting on the temple, we are sitting under a tree next to the temple. And we were thinking maybe we should cook something. We didn't have any food with us carrying it. We thought that we'll buy some food. But then some people came from the village and sat around us, started to ask questions. And in no time they just came with the food. The grains and vegetables and all. And so the boys cooked the food and we took prasad. We gave them prasad. We had a wonderful time. And that night, all these village people got together and we just spent the night in the temple. And that's how we got the idea what to do. So from then onwards, what we do, we just come to a village and find a temple. Every village has some sort of temple or something. And we'd sit down and every day it would happen the same way. In the morning we'd start to walk for about 10-12 kilometers, stop in a village, and people would come. And in this way we came to a city called Kalka. And when we were approaching the city, somebody on a scooter just stopped. And he asked, "Are you all from ISKCON?" So I said, "Yes." And so he said, my father is a member of ISKCON." He was quite a youngish boy. I think he was still a college student. He said, "My father is a life member of ISKCON. So where are you going?" So I said, "We are heading for Kalka." So he said, "Look, I'm just going ahead. And when I go there, I'll make some arrangements for you all." And so by the time we reached Kalka is a middle-sized city. When we came to the city, I found a whole lot of people waiting for us. So they gave us a grand reception. We just went and we found that they made arrangements for us in a dharamshala. That dharamshala happens to be their dharamshala. They're quite wealthy people in there. And we stayed there for 3 days. And every night we used to have a program. And it was a hall which was maybe not that this big, but maybe say about the half of this hall. It was packed every day. So generally, that is how respectful people are towards the sadhus. And this I'm talking about 79, when ISKCON was not that, ISKCON did not enjoy such a reputation as ISKCON does in India today. But at the same time, there are people who are also quite strange. That reminds me of another incident. So, while walking, we came to a place, actually practically in the middle of nowhere, and it was on the bank of a river. There was a kind of a tent, and there were some people who were gathering there. They were sitting on kind of chopais and things. And seeing us walking, they just called us. So we went, and we saw these people are quite robust. And so I thought in Punjab, you know, everyone is like that. Punjabis are generally quite robust people. And so one of these guys, he was quite a youngish person, like he was asking us questions. And there was one person we could see that he is their leader. He is their boss. And the youngish guy, he was asking us, and it came to a point, he was asking us what is our sampradaya, what is our parampara. And this big guy just slapped him. He told him, what do you understand about all that? You're asking these questions to them. He said, just listen to them. And this is how the encounter started. And they, those days, we used to cook our own food. So they also honored that. They gave us wheat and sabjis and all. So we cooked. And then when we were leaving, he sent one man to take us to the river, to cross the river. We had to walk somewhere to get a boat. And this person gave us a donation also. There were about 8-9 people of them, you know, like all very robust. And so this person who was taking us to the river, he just told me, do you know who we are? He said, we are dacoits. And he is our leader. But I found this person to be so nice to us. I mean, by his appearance, he was really frightening. I mean, to think of it. He was a frightening character, but he was so nice to us. So this is India. Even the dacoits are so respectful to the sadhus. The way these people were, I had a kind of a feeling that something is strange with these people. Because the way they were addressing each other, the way they were talking to each other, was very crude and very aggressive and... But to me, they were so respectful. when he was sitting on the bank, this Avanti Brahmana, when he was sitting on the bank of a river, about to partake of the food that he had collected by his begging, such sinful rascals would come and pass urine on it, and they would dare to spit on his head. Although he had taken a vow of silence, they would try to make him speak, and if he did not speak, they would beat him with sticks. Others would chastise him, saying, "This man is just a thief." And others would bind him up with rope, shouting, "Tie him up, tie him up." They would criticize and insult him, saying, "This man is just a hypocrite and a cheat. He makes a business of religion simply because he lost all his wealth and his family threw him out." Some would ridicule him by saying, "Just see this greatly powerful sage. He is as steadfast as Himalayan mountains. By practice of silence, he strives for his goal with a great determination, just like a duck." You get the point. You see, there is a swan, and a duck also looks like a swan. Right? But their natures are completely different, especially a crane. A crane, I don't know whether you have seen, a crane stands on one leg on water, as if he's meditating. But what is his attention focused on? His attention is focused on a fish. As soon as it sees a fish, just catch it. So, therefore, there's a big difference between a swan and a crane. Although they look somewhat alike, and although it seems that the crane is meditating. Some would ridicule him by saying, "Just see this greatly powerful sage. He is as steadfast as the Himalayan mountains. By practice of silence, he strives for his goal with great determination, just like a duck." Other persons would pass foul air upon him, and sometimes others would bind this twice one Brahmana in chains and keep him captive like a pet animal. Because he was silent, he took the vow of silence, he would not protest. The Brahmana understood that all his suffering from other living beings, from the higher forces of nature, and from his own body was unavoidable, being allotted to him by providence. Even while being insulted by these low-class men who were trying to effect his downfall, he remained steady in his spiritual duties. Fixing his resolution in the mode of goodness, he began to chant the following song. The Brahmana said, "These people are not the cause of my happiness and distress. Neither are the demigods, my own body, the planets, my past work, or time. Rather, it is the mind alone that causes happiness and distress and perpetuates the rotation of material life." See, there actually, according to the Vedic understanding, there are different causes of our of the happenings in our life. Things don't just happen by chance or by accident. So the Brahmana said, "These people are not the cause of my happiness or distress. These people are not the cause. Neither the demigods. Because generally, apparently what's happening, these people are causing the distress. If we go even further, then the demigods make these arrangements according to a karma. Karmana daivanetrena. Daivanetrena, the divine eyes, are watching our karma. Neither the demigods. My own body. My body is also, although it's receiving these distresses, that's not actually the cause of my distress. The planets also have the influence of what happens in our life. My past work, my karma, or time. So he's considering all these, which are considered to be the cause of our happenings. Demigods, my own body, the planets, my past work, or time. It is the mind alone that causes happiness and distress and perpetuates the rotation of material life. The mind is actually the cause of everything he's considering. Because everything is happening in mind. The powerful mind actuates the functions of the material modes from which evolve the different kinds of material activities in the modes of goodness, ignorance and passion. From the activities in each of these modes develop the corresponding statuses of life. Although present along with the struggling mind within the material body, the super soul is not endeavoring because he is already endowed with transcendental enlightenment. Acting as my friend, he simply witnesses from his transcendental position. I, the infinitesimal spirit soul, on the other hand, have embraced this mind, which is the mirror of mirror, reflecting the image of the material world. Wonderful point. The mind is the mirror that is reflecting the images of the material world. Thus I have become engaged in enjoying objects of desire and am entangled due to contact with the modes of nature. Charity, prescribed duties, observance of major and minor regulative principles, Hearing from scriptures, pious work and purifying vows all have their final aim in subduing the mind. Now, all these are meant to subdue the mind. Charity, prescribed duties, observance of major and minor regulative principles, hearing from scriptures, pious work and purifying vows all have their final aim to subduing of the mind. Indeed, concentration of the mind on the Supreme is the highest yoga. The concentration of the mind on the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the highest yoga. If one's mind is perfectly fixed and pacified, then tell me, what need does one have to perform ritualistic charity and other pious rituals? And if one's mind remains uncontrolled, lost in ignorance, then what use are these engagements for him? So the thing is, if the mind is fixed on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then what is the use of all those activities? There is no need because the final goal has been achieved. And on the other hand, if the mind remains uncontrolled, lost in ignorance, then also what's the use of all these activities? The purpose is not served. All the senses have been under the control of the mind since time immemorial. It's the mind that is controlling the senses. It is the mind that is dictating the senses. Mind says, look at that. Isn't it? Like just as I pointed out yesterday. Do you see this? Now that I reminded you, your mind says, look at that. Mind immediately tells the eyes, look at that. Did you hear this? Mind is saying, did you hear this? It directs the ears to hear. So in this way, the mind is dictating the senses, controlling the senses. And mind also is the inner sense. All the senses function under the influence of mind. If the mind is not linked to the senses don't perceive. It is through the senses that the mind is perceiving. All the senses have been the control, had senses been under the control of the mind since time immemorial. And the mind himself never comes under the sway of any other. He is stronger than the strongest, and his godlike power is fearsome. Therefore, anyone who can bring the mind under control becomes the master of all senses. Failing to conquer this irrepressible enemy, the mind, whose urges are intolerable and who torments the heart, many people are completely bewildered and create useless quarrel with others. Thus they conclude that other people are either their friends, their enemies, or parties indifferent to them. Persons who identify with this body, which is simply the product of the material mind, are blinded in their intelligence, thinking in terms of I and mine, because of the illusion of this is I, but that is someone else, they wander in endless darkness. If you say that these people are the cause of my happiness and distress, then where is the place of the soul in such a conception? This happiness and distress pertain not to the soul, but to the interaction of material bodies. They don't pertain to the soul, but the interaction of material bodies. The concept of happiness and distress does not take place or pertain to the soul, but it's an interaction between material bodies. If someone bites his tongue with his own teeth, at whom can he become angry in his suffering? So this way he goes one after another. Is the body the cause? Are the demigods are the cause? The first consideration was? First consideration was the body, then the demigods. So then about the demigods he is concluding. If you say that the demigods who rule the bodily senses cause suffering, still, how can such suffering apply to the spirit soul? This acting and being acted upon are merely interaction of the changeable senses and their presiding deities. When one limb of the body attacks another, with whom can the person in that body be angry? So, even if you say that demigods are the cause, then still the suffering cannot apply to the spirit soul. this being acted, this acting and being acted upon are merely interaction of the changeless senses and their presiding deities. If the soul himself were the cause of happiness and distress, then we could not blame others, since happiness and distress would be simply the nature of the soul. According to this theory, nothing except the soul would actually exist. And if we were to perceive something besides the soul, that would be illusion. Therefore, since happiness and distresses do not actually exist in this concept, why become angry at oneself or others? If we examine the hypothesis that the planets are the immediate cause of suffering and happiness, then also, where is the relationship with the soul, who is eternal? After all, the effect of the planets applies only to things that have taken birth. Expert astrologers moreover explain how the planets are only causing pain to each other. Planets are only causing pain to each other. Therefore, since the living entity is distinct from these planets and from the material body, against whom should he vent his anger? If we assume that fruitive work is the cause of happiness and distress, we still are not dealing with the soul. The idea of material work arises when there is a spiritual actor who is conscious, and a material body that undergoes the transformation of happiness and distress as a reaction of such work. Since the body has no life, it cannot be the actual recipient of happiness and distress, nor can the soul, ultimately completely spiritual and aloof from the material body. Since karma thus has no ultimate basis in either the body and the soul, at whom can one become angry? So whatever the cause is, we can't be angry at the cause. If we accept time as the cause of happiness and distress, that experience still cannot apply to the spirit soul, since time is a manifestation of the Lord's spiritual potency, and the living entities are also expansions of the Lord's spiritual potency manifesting through them. So, time, this is actually a very beautiful point. Time is a manifestation of the Lord's potency. The spirit soul also is the manifestation of Lord's spiritual potency. And the living entities are also expansions of the Lord's spiritual potency, manifesting through time. Certainly, a fire does not burn its own flames or sparks. So because time is the expansion of the Lord's spiritual potency, the spirit souls are expansion of Lord's spiritual potency through time, then just as a part of fire cannot be burnt by fire, similarly the soul cannot be affected by whatever is happening in course of time. And another example he gives is, nor does the cold harm its own snowflakes or hail. In fact, the spirit soul is transcendental and beyond the experience of material happiness and distress. At whom, therefore, should one become angry? The false ego gives shape to illusory material existence and thus experiences material happiness and distress. The spirit soul, however, is transcendental to material nature. He can never be actually affected by material happiness and distress in any place, under any circumstances, or by the agency of any person. A person who understands this has nothing whatsoever to fear from the material creation. A person who understands this has nothing whatsoever to fear from the material creation. Then he comes to a very beautiful point at the conclusion of this verse. I shall cross over the insurmountable ocean of nations by being firmly fixed in the service of the lotus feet of Krishna. This was approved by the previous acharyas who were fixed in firm devotion to the Lord Paramatma, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. When Prabhupada gave me sannyas, Prabhupada asked me to chant this mantra every day when I chant Gayatri. So it's a beautiful, so this is how relevant this Avanti Brahmana episode is with us. Avanti Brahmana, actually Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur also, he took that mantra as a guideline for sannyasis. Etam sa asthaya paratma nishtham. Adhashitam purvatamai mahadbhir aham tarishyami durantaparam tamo mukundangri nishevayaiva. I shall cross over aham tarishyami. Tarishyami means cross over. Durantaparam, the insurmountable ocean of nations. Material world is like an insurmountable ocean of nations. Aham tarishyami durantaparam tamo, durantaparam tamo, darkness or nation. Mukundangri nishevayeva. By serving the lotus feet, by firmly being fixed in the service of the lotus feet of Mukunda Krishna. And this was approved by the previous acharyas. Etam sa asthaya paratma nishtham upadhashitam purvatamair mahatvi. Purvatamair, the previous mahatvi, great personalities, the acharyas. This was approved by the previous acharyas who were fixed in firm devotion to the Lord Paramatma. Paratma Nishtha, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Maybe we can also just go through this song of the Avanti Brahmana. This few shlokas. So it starts from text 42 and goes on, it's quite a few, goes on to text 57, so 16 verses. Let me see. Dija uvacha nayam janome sukha dukkha hetu na devatatma graha karma kala manah parankarana mananti samsara chakram parivartayet jat mano gunan vai srijate baliyas tatascha karmani vilakshanani shuklani krishnanathalohitani tebhya savarna shritayo bhavanti aniha atma manasa samihata hiranmayo matsakha utti chashti manasya lingam parigriha kaman jushan nibaddha guna sangatoso danam sadharmo niyamo jamascha shrutam cha karmani cha sadbratani sarve mano nigraha lakshananta parohi yoga manaso samadhi samahitam jasya mano prashantam dana dibhi king badatasya krityam asanjatam yasyo mano binashyat dana dibhischeda param kimebhi mano bashene hi bhavan smadeva manascha nanasya basham samiti bhishmo hi deva sahasa sahiyan junjayad vashetam sahi deva deva tandur jayam shatru mashacha vegam arun tadam tanna vijitta kechit kurvanta sadvi grahamatra mantai mitran nudashina ripun vimura dehang mano matra mimam grihita mama hamitta nadhiyo manusha esho hamanno jamiti brahmena duranta pare tamasi brahmanti janastu hetu sukha dukha yoschet kimat manaschatraha bhi bhomayostat jivham kachit sam dashati shadadvi tadvedanayam katamaya kuppet dukha sahetur jadi devatastu kimatmanastatra vikara justa jadangamangena nihannate kachit krudheta kashmai purusha sadehe atma yadishat sukha dukha hetu kimannatastatra nijasya bhava nahi atma mano nad jadi tanmishasva krudheta kashmanna sukhanna dukham graha nimittam sukha dukha yoshche kimatmano yashasya janasati vai grahair grahashaiva vadanti pidham krudheta kashmai purushastatonna karmastu dhetu sukha dukha yoshche kimatmanastadvi jada jadatve dehastachit purushoyam suparnam krudheta kashmai nahi karma mulam kalastu hetu sukha dukha yoschet kimatmanastatra tadatma kosho nāgnerhatāpi na himasatatshyāt kruddheta kashmai na parasadandam na kena chitkvāpi kathascha kathancha nāśya dando parāgo paratah parasya jatha hama sanskriti rupinasya devam prabuddho na viveti bhutai etam sa asthaya paratma nishtham adhasitam purvatamair maharshibhi aham tarishyami durantaparam tamo mukundam hridishevaiva. Isn't it beautiful? Such a beautiful prayer by this Avanti Brahman. And then Sri Krishna told Uddhava, thus becoming detached upon the loss of his property, this sage gave up his moroseness. He left home taking sannyas and began to travel about the earth. Even when insulted by foolish rascals, he remained unswerved from his duty and chanted this song. He just kept on chanting this song. No other force beside his own mental confusion makes the soul experience happiness and distress. His perception of friends, neutral parties, and enemies and the whole material life he builds around this perception are simply created out of ignorance. My dear Uddhava, fixing your intelligence upon me, you should thus completely control the mind. This is the essence of the science of yoga. Anyone who listens to or recites to others the song of the sannyasi, which presents scientific knowledge of the absolute, and who thus meditates upon it with full attention, will never again be overwhelmed by the dualities of material happiness and distress. Meaning, if we properly understand the realization of this Avanti Brahmana, then we will become free from the duality of the duality of happiness and distress of this material nature. Hare Krishna. So, some time for question answers. Hare Krishna. Give him the mic.
Last point you made, the mind is a mirror that reflects the material nature. What exactly is it?
Yeah. The objects of the material nature are there. And how do we perceive that? Only when it is reflected in the mind. Right? If the mind is not there, we'll see anything. Will there be any reflection of this material nature? That's the point. Hare Krishna, Shyamal Krishna.
Hare Krishna, Guru Maharaj. I have two questions to Parvin. The first question is, the Avanti Kamana sings the first verse. The Avanti Kamana, I mean, song in the first verse says that actually, the demigods, the planets, the karmic reactions, the body, etc., are not the cause of suffering. The mind is.
He is not saying that they are not the cause of the pain. He is saying they are the cause, but we should not think that they are, you know, they are to be blamed as such. Not they are the cause, they are having their influence or effect. But ultimately, it is the mind. Like nothing else is the actual cause. The actual cause is the mind.
The second question is when it said there's a text which says that when one limb of the body hurts another, who is to blame? Or when the tongue bites the teeth, who is to blame? So that sounds to me something like Maya, which, you know, like where he's saying that everything is the same, can't blame anyone in particular. So how do I understand?
The aspect of knowledge is something like that, you know. When you go into delve into knowledge, just depend upon knowledge, it is leading to some sort of impersonal conclusion. So yeah, it's true, like it is, it sounds like Mayavada. Like ultimately, you know, this knowledge, what it is leading, it's leading to non-duality in a way, leading that everything is a dream. But that is not our consider. Yes, it's like a dream, as I mentioned, but it's a collective dream. It's not my dream or your dream. It's a collective dream. So if it is a dream, who is causing the dream? Mahavishnu is causing the dream. Right? It's because of his glance that the material nature became manifest. When he'll withdraw the glance, it'll disappear. Material nature became as active, manifest because of his glance. But the thing is, but the main point is that yes, our philosophy is as a dream it's real. Because Mahavishnu's dream. Therefore it's real. And if we are caught up in that, we are a part of it. You know, it's reality for us. It may be Mahavishnu's projection, but we are caught up in this illusory situation, illusory reality. Like for us, spiritual reality is reality, this is also a reality. Only the difference is that is real reality, this is reflected reality. When there is a reflection of a tree in a pool of water, then we have to admit that as a reflection it is there. As a reflection it is there, not as the tree it's there. The reflection it is there. That is our philosophy. Okay. Let me answer this one while you are giving the thing. Devaki Nandini, okay. Uddhava is a favorite devotee of Krishna and he studied the Chatushloki and the four very great important verses from Srimad Bhagavatam. Please explain briefly, when Vidura asked Uddhava to get knowledge from him, he said he should take from Maitreya Muni. He said that because he knew that Krishna instructed Maitreya Rishi to instruct Vidura. Therefore, he didn't instruct him. Because Krishna told Maitreya to instruct Vidura. Yes.
As he had taken that cup, it seems intelligence of Krishna became tremble of mind.
Fixing.
Can you explain that's how practical?
What's that?
How practically we is our intelligence?
How to practically, is the intelligence when engaged, is engaged in how to serve Krishna. And that is called Buddhi Yoga. That is called devotional service. You become engaged in serving Krishna and use your intelligence how to serve Krishna. Okay, that is how you fix your intelligence in serving Krishna. Alright? Hare Krishna. Ramananda?
In relation to this dreaming and all the things, I have another question. What is the difference and relation between imagination, dreaming, and vision?
It is imagination when the functioning of the subtle body is, when the subtle body is functioning, when the gross body is awake. Right? And the gross body is awake and the subtle body is functioning. That is imagination. When the gross body is inactive or asleep, but the subtle body is active, it is dreaming. You get it? That's the difference between imagination and dream. So what was your third point?
Vision.
Huh?
Vision.
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 A vision is seeing something which is really there. Like for example, this room, I'm visualizing, right? But if I remember the temple room in Radha Desh, then I'm imagining, right? But when I'm fast asleep and talking to Ramananda Rai, that is my dream.
Martin Luther King said, I had a dream. Where do we situate that?
Huh?
Martin Luther King, he said, I had a dream. So where do we situate that?
Dream means when he was sleeping or when he was awake? So they actually it is his imagination that he's presenting as a dream. Actually he should say, I imagine, I think, I wish. So that is, wishful thinking can be considered to be a dream. My wishful thinking. My wishful thinking. But when you say literally dream, then it is experienced when you are asleep. Now where the dream is experienced? In the subtle body. That's what Krishna explained in the previous chapter. Three stages of consciousness. Wakeful, dream, deep sleep. Yes, pass the mic there. Oh, piche. The point actually is that they're there, but you know, as a sannyasi, he is considering that I shouldn't become affected by all these. I can't blame anybody. I can't even blame my past karma. It's all, you know, my mind's. So let me fix. So he's coming ultimately to the point. Let me fix my mind to Krishna's lotus feet. That is the ultimate conclusion. The adi-atmik, adi-bhautik, adi-daivik, they're all there. Even these causes are there. The devas are there, the karma is there, the time factor is there. All these are there. But we can't really blame them. Even I can't blame my own karma. What is actually, all this is a product of my mind. That's what he is actually coming to conclude. Therefore, let me now offer my mind to Krishna. And that will solve all the problems. Yes, Vinod Bihari. Oh, there is someone here? Okay.
Krishna Guru Maharaj. Maharaj, my question is related to the morning Bhagavatam class. When you were talking about the four sampradayas, So Maharaj, I've always wondered that there are certain people that I've come across, at least in Ujjain, who come across as very devout worshippers of Lord Krishna, yet they're not of one of the four sampradayas. So Maharaj, I was wondering what is their destination?
You see, this is the thing, like, one may develop his attachment to Krishna and because of so many different factors. Like, you're born in the land of Krishna. There, you know, like, people heard about Krishna and they saw devotees and so forth. But ultimately, when it comes to, you know, the Vaishnava practice, and the important aspect is the mantra, like, then the sampradayas are needed. Like, as I said, like, early days, mantras were not available. Now the situation is different. Now these four sampradayas won't be that important, because Mahaprabhu gave the holy name. So anybody can chant the Hare Krishna Mahamantra. Right? And by that, doing that, one can become a Vaishnava. One can become a devotee of Krishna. But then again, we have to see that where is the root of it? Ultimately, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So they are coming to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu Sampradaya, knowing or unknowing. Or the effects of some sampradaya. It is, okay, another way to look at it is, some people learn something just by hearing or seeing others. But when one learns in a proper way, going to the school, going to the university, there is a difference in that learning. When you go to the institute, an educational institute, and learn it under the qualified teacher in a systematic way, it has its different effect. But at the same time, jenatena prakarena mona krishna niveshay. If you can fix your mind in Krishna, somehow or other, it's fine. I heard of many people. Who was that? Let me try to... One of our devotees, he mentioned about his grandmother. He was from East Africa. I think Kenya or Uganda. And he was telling me that when his grandmother left her body, she was very devoted to Krishna. It's long before they came in contact with ISKCON. And his grandmother, actually, before leaving her body, told them that on such and such, next morning, I'm going to leave my body. And please make this arrangement. Put me on the floor, on the bare floor, and clean up that floor with cow dung and all that. And it's really amazing. And she left her body in that way. So obviously, she was an advanced devotee, although she was not initiated in any sampradaya. So instances like that will be there. Incidentally, the gopis don't belong in any sampradaya. They have their own sampradaya. Radharani sampradaya. Hare Krishna. Yes, Lila Madhuri. Where's the mic? Oh, the mic is here. Sorry, wait. Yeah, Vinod Bihari.
So, the story of this Avanti Ramana, before he was a merchant,
I was a really wicked and miserly person, right? So then it seems that he got the mercy of Krishna.
He was that?
He got the mercy of Krishna.
Yeah, yeah.
And everything was taken away from him. And the realization came to him that it's the mercy of Krishna. So how come a wicked, greedy, miserly person get such kind of...
How come?
Such a greedy, miserly and wicked person get mercy from Krishna.
Well, he was miserly, but then, you see, when he lost everything, then he developed detachment, which actually meant that he is now surrendering to Krishna. So Krishna mercifully brought him to that situation when he developed his realization, and that came as Krishna's mercy.
But like taking away the money from him was not mercy.
Yeah, Krishna said, Jasaham anukrindhami varishet adhanam shanahi. Upon whom I bestow my mercy, I steal away all his wealth. But you have to be qualified to receive that kind of mercy. Prabhupada actually said that Krishna won't do this to an unqualified person. Then he may lose his Krishna consciousness. Then he may lose his faith in Krishna. So Krishna will do that to an advanced person only. Take away everything. Yes, Leela Madhavi.
Hare Krishna. I'm asking this question on behalf of one Mataji who was asking if someone, a devotee, doesn't have a guru, possible that they go back to Godhead?
Yeah, as I said, anything is possible in this age. He may not have a guru in a formality, he may not have formally taken initiation, but as you say, the devotee, how did he become a devotee? How did he become a devotee? Huh? By the mercy of Srila Prabhupada. So Prabhupada's books, Prabhupada's devotees, so one can become a devotee in that way. So that means he has a guru. Prabhupada is his guru. That he is, like in a real sense, he got it from Srila Prabhupada. Krishna. Guru is the one who gives you Krishna. So if he got Krishna through Srila Prabhupada and his books and other arrangements, then we have to consider that he has a guru. That is Srila Prabhupada. And so many things can happen actually. It is not that formal initiation as such that really is the main criteria. What if at that time, seeing that the person is sincerely trying to become Krishna conscious, what if Narad Muni comes? Will you be able to see Narad Muni? When he is about to leave his body, when he is in deathbed, what if he encounters Narad Muni and Narad Muni instructs him? Narad Muni bestows his mercy upon him. That's also possible. It can happen in that another plane. Or what if Krishna himself comes, taking special compassion upon him?
Once you told me that devotee cannot worship Krishna directly. One has to go through his guru.
Who? What happened?
Your holiness, your
okay. Go ahead.
One cannot worship Krishna unless one goes through his guru.
Okay. Yeah, that is a consideration, you know. You can't whimsically get the... It's like The process is that you approach Krishna through a bona fide spiritual master. The point is you should not directly approach Krishna. Worshipping Krishna, that is what we follow. We go through Srila Prabhupada. When you offer arati, what do you do? First take permission from Srila Prabhupada. Or another thing is that what I often tell the devotees, that don't just go to Vrindavan. Now that you have gone to Vrindavan, come to Vrindavan, and you go to Lohi Bazaar and you see a beautiful deity of Radha Krishna costing only 5,000 rupees, and you calculate, 5,000 rupees, only $100. So let me just buy it. No, one should not get Krishna in this way. One should take permission. Am I qualified to worship Krishna? And then only, because there are so many different considerations that people don't really consider. Like, you are installing the deities of Radha Krishna. When you go for a vacation, who is going to take care of the deities? When you grow old and completely incapacitated, who is going to take care of the deities? Like I've seen, these are from my own experience, like some devotees, they have become she is very old, and in the house nobody is taking care of the deities. And she, in spite of her old age, has to do everything. I mean, she is benefiting naturally, but the thing is, then the question is, like, what about the deity worship after she leaves the body? So that's why, there should be due consideration.
Guru Maharaj, when someone accepts a spiritual master, it's eternal, right? But what happens if the disciple doesn't make it in this lifetime? Then what happens?
Yeah, I go ahead again.
One accepts a spiritual master in this lifetime, but doesn't make it, and the goal in this lifetime, then what happens? Because that relationship is eternal.
It will depend upon the spiritual master. In this respect, Prabhupada gave an example. When you are in a boat crossing a river, the boatman is responsible for you only as long as you're in the boat. Right? If you jump overboard, then the boatman may rescue you or may not rescue you. Right? So the point is, the spiritual master will hold himself responsible only as long as the disciple is listening to his instructions and acting accordingly. If the disciple rejects him or rejects his instructions, then the spiritual master may not feel obliged to. So I've been asked to make some announcement. Recently, a lot of research and arrangements are going on for the retreat in Europe. So after a lot of research and a lot of investigation, a lot of planning and such endeavors, it has been finally decided that the dates for European retreat will be from 16th to 20th July. It is a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th. Oh, so no, it's actually starting then on Wednesday. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 20th is a Sunday. So the idea will be on 20th evening they can leave so that they can start work from Monday the 21st. And the retreat will be in Spain. As I told you, after a lot of research, this decision has been made. It'll be in Spain. Venue is Malaga in Costa del Sol. You know, Costa del Sol means in Spanish the coast of sun. Okay, and a hotel has been entirely booked just for the devotees' retreat. And probably many of you who attended these retreats know how, what kind of, although it sounds mentioned hotel, but this hotel actually becomes an ashram. The banquet hall of the hotel becomes the pujari room, the temple room. The dining hall becomes the prasadam hall. And all that. And so the hotel has already been booked. The same hotel, Vinod Bihari? The same one. How many of you have attended the retreat in Spain? Okay. Yeah, so the same hotel. Right on the bank of the ocean. Oh no, it's not exactly on the bank. It's the one on the side of the ocean, on the other side of the road. Across, where we did before. We last, once we had two hotels, no? One on the other, see this side of the hotel is next to the beach and the other side of the road is, you have to cross the road and go to the beach. Okay, it's beautiful. And so you're informing them well in advance so that you can prepare yourself. Anyone wishing to book, kindly contact His Grace Vinod Bihari Das and his good wife, Hemagori Dasi. Or Priyabrata Das. The capacity of the hotel is limited to 165 persons only. Further details will be posted on BCS Ishtagoshti on a regular basis. Okay, thank you very much. And also, next year, the retreat also will be here. At the same time, that means right after Christmas, just between Christmas and New Year. Christmas Day is 25th and 26th to 31st. And we will, I think they got a name for this, the International Seminar. What is the name of this seminar? Global Seminar. Global. So national, the annual global feature is a seminar here. Did you, how do you, how you all are, enjoying this seminar. How is the arrangement here? How many of you went in the cruise? Which one was better, this one or the cruise?
This one.
Sure? Then there is no need to have a cruise. So, should he charge more than that? Actually, I also was not so fond of the cruise. Because first of all, it was so expensive. And we don't need. I mean, see, what really matters, we are hearing and chanting is what really matters. You know, being in the ocean in a 5-star ocean liner is not really necessary for us. Whereas this is so nice, like in a temple, we have plenty of arrangements, and that was another problem with the cruise in the ocean liner, that prasadam was, because they don't allow the cooks to go in because they have very stringent laws about who can enter into the kitchen. They have to be qualified. And after a lot of struggle, we got two of our devotees to cook. And they were cooking. They couldn't really attend the seminars or anything. Whereas here you come, all of you are free to just participate in the seminar and take advantage of all these, the devotees of all these wonderful devotees, association of all these wonderful devotees. Thank you all very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Gaur Premanande.